I'm Jay Levinson, the director of the international program here at MoMA, and I'd like to welcome you to today's program on post-war Japanese art, a panel and a discussion. This program is actually the result of a curatorial exchange. This summer, three of our curators, Connie Butler, the chief curator of drawings, Roxana Marcoach, the curator of photography, and Sarah Suzuki, assistant curator of prints and illustrated books, traveled to Japan on a research trip. Following their visit and their meetings with curators, artists, scholars, and critics in Japan, we worked closely with the Japan Foundation here to invite four Japanese curators, Michiko Kasahara, Akira Takahata, Midori Matsui, and Fumihiko Sumitomo, to come to New York this week to engage in discussions with a group of our curators at MoMA. This evening's program actually falls between our two curatorial discussions, and we thought this would be a good way to open up the subject to a broader audience, and we thank you very much for coming tonight and participating in our project. I should explain that the curators are not going to present an overall history of post-war Japanese art in the time we have. We asked each curator to focus on a specific subject within that person's area of interest. So what you'll hear are four presentations on different aspects of post-war Japanese art. Before we begin the program, there are thanks to go around. I really want to thank our co-organizers at the Japan Foundation, especially Tatsuaki Kobayashi, the director, and Kenji Matsumoto, the program director for arts and culture. They've really helped us tremendously, both here and also during our curator's trip to Japan. We also want to thank the sponsors of our curatorial travel to Japan, the Asian Cultural Council, and MoMA's own International Council. I want to thank our visiting curators for coming here at what I know are very busy time of the year, taking the time to help study with us our own collection of Japanese works, speak with our curators, and participate in the program tonight. And I want to thank the members of our own curatorial and senior staffs who've helped us prepare this program, especially Connie Butler, who'll be tonight's moderator, Kathy Halbreich, Roxana Marcoach, Peter Reed, and Sarah Suzuki. And I also want to thank members of my department, Gwen Farrelly, Carolina Scarborough, Sylvia Renner, who've worked tirelessly to ensure the success of this program. So I'd like to turn the podium over now to Roxana Marcoach, who'll tell you a bit about the first part of this curatorial exchange. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you all for joining us. It is my great pleasure to offer some preliminary remarks on the post-war Japanese art, a panel and discussion which, as Jay has mentioned, is organized as part of an exchange between MoMA curators and a group of distinguished scholars and curators of modern and contemporary art from Japan. Can we have the slides going on, please? Yeah, and just let it run. Great, thanks. What you see here, by the way, are just snapshots from the trip that we took. And as also Jay mentioned, this panel tonight constitutes just the second part of a curatorial and research program that began in June of this year when I had the pleasure of traveling with my colleague Connie Butler, who is, as Jay mentioned, going to moderate tonight's panel, and Sarah Suzuki to Japan. In less than 2 weeks, we crisscrossed several cities, going back and forth from Tokyo to Kyoto, from Osaka to Hiroshima, and from Ashiya to Hyogo. And we traveled to Japan with a very simple, very genuine also desire to meet with emerging and also established artists, affiliated and independent curators, scholars, critics, academics, gallerists, and art collectors. It was a thrilling experience. We learned a lot, and that led us to the next step. Basically forming, informing, and being informed by an ad hoc critical platform from which we could exchange ideas, which explains the second part of the exchange, including the panel tonight. So it is my privilege to introduce our guest panelist. Ms. Michiko Kazahara is a chief curator at the Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography, and she has organized numerous exhibitions focusing on contemporary Japanese art and photography, including On Your Body in 2008, On Landscape in 2002, and Kiss in the Dark in 2001. And for a selected list of Mrs. Kazahara's impressive curatorial history, please refer to the biographical handouts. Certainly, one of the highlights of our trip was visiting her institution and seeing there a major retrospective of Japanese artist Daido Moriyama. And I should mention that during her previous tenure as a curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Tokyo, Ms. Kazahara was also invited to serve as commissioner at the 51st Venice Biennale, which took place in 2005, where she curated a beautiful installation of Ishiyuki Miyako's work titled Mothers, 2000-2005, Traces of the Future. That exhibition certainly remains as one of my fondest memories of Venice that year. And like much of Mrs. Kazahara's scholarship, the show focused on a leading woman photographer's poignant work. As curator of photography, I cannot emphasize enough the significance that photography has played in Japanese culture since it was first introduced to Japan in 1848, towards the end of the Edo period. And I'm also emphasizing this because this month is the month of photography, and tonight Paris is opening Parifoto, which is honoring Japan by featuring the work of more than 130 artists from the Meiji era in the 1860s to the avant-garde movement in the 30s and from the post-World War II years to the most contemporary production. Also tonight, we are very pleased that Dr. Midori Matsui, a multi-dexterous scholar, who is as conversant with Japanese culture as she is with Western art, will redefine the post-war history of Japanese pop art and micro-pop movements. Dr. Matsui is renowned for her contributions to numerous publications, including Little Boy, The Arts of Japan's Exploding Subculture, which took place at the Japan Society in 2005, Public Offerings, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles in 2001, and Painting at the Edge of the World at the Walker Art Center in 2001, to name just a few. In addition, joining tonight's panel is Mr. Akira Tatehata, art critic and art award-winning poet, as well as the director of the National Museum of Art Osaka, where he has shaped a provocative exhibition program of post-war and contemporary art. Mr. Tatehata, who has also served as commissioner for Japan at both the 44th and 45th Venice Biennale in 1990-1995, and was the co-director of the Yokohama Triennale in 2001, will examine issues pertaining to the local global debate in contemporary Japanese art by focusing on the artistic practices of Onkavara and Yayoi Kusama. And I'd like to conclude by introducing Mr. Fumihiko Sumitomo, senior curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art, Tokyo, who is an expert of Japanese experimental art and performance collectives between the 50s, 1950s, and 70s. Mr. Sumitomo organized this year alone the retrospective exhibition Tadashi Kawamata Walkway and served as curator for the third Nanjing Triennale. A key member of Arts Initiative Tokyo AIT, a nonprofit and independent collective of curators and art administrators based in Tokyo, whose mission is to provide a much-needed new public forum for contemporary art, Mr. Sumitomo and his colleague, Ms. Yuko Hasegawa, chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art Tokyo, were instrumental in broadening our understanding of the avant-garde groups of Japan's post-war period, especially of the little-known Jiken Kobo group and the better-known Gutai group. From the 1950s, intermediate experiments in performance and stage design constituted early examples of collaborative collectivism that prefigured the activities of Neo-Dada, Hi-Rez Center, and Fluxus, to name a few of the experimental groups that transformed the 1960s and the subsequent landscape of contemporary art. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming the panelists.
Good evening. As a first speaker, I would like to thank the staff of MoMA and also the staff of Japan Foundation for inviting us to have this wonderful opportunity to introduce Japanese art and also to discuss with the curator of MoMA and also with the people who came to the symposium tonight. I think since the large attention of the art people is going to China right now, we think this is a very important opportunity to talk about the Japanese art scene. And also, it is very important for us to learn about a view from American people because this half century of Japanese art is greatly influenced by American art scene. So I will begin with the first picture I have here is on your right hand side. It is the very famous paintings by Masao Tsuruoka. It was made in 1949. And on left hand side is the picture of the Osaka Expo on 1970. So there's only 20 years difference between these two images. I will begin by referring to the early activities of well-known Gutai Art Association. The Gutai artists principally included Shozo Shimamoto, Kazuo Shiraga, Atsuko Tanaka, Akira Katayama, and Saburo Murakami, and so on. In their early stage, Gutai shows its extinguishing character, which is to say an art expression that bypassed the concept of what to paint as a subject and focused more on the process of how to paint and bringing them directly in confrontation with the thing or the matter itself. This was exemplified by Shimamoto, who opened the holes in his canvas, and Shiraga, who violently applied paint using his feet. Murakami's performance, Passage, was an act of breaking through successive sheets of paper stretched in wooden frames. It looks like a childish act, which is true because one day Murakami saw his child make a hole and appear through the shoji paper screen, a traditional Japanese slide screen, which inspired this performance. Each time Murakami broke through a sheet of stretched paper, he would be so shocked by the impact. It is like one time experienced a death-like state. While it was a very simple act, viewers watching Murakami suddenly emerge on the other side, were witness to a repetition of death and rebirth. It was also an act of opening a hole in the space separating two sides and thus moving through thresholds. The artist of Gutai, instead of assigning some other substitute symbols to the things, brought them into the work as employing direct experiences. Things are not controlled by the system of meanings and its signs, but rather exist as something obscure and remain uncanny. The next group I'm going to introduce is the group called Play. A group launched in 1964 appears to be seen differently from the anti-art-oriented avant-garde movement of that time. Although Play did take their activities out of art institutions like museums, they did not adopt a clear posture of confrontation against it. This perhaps gave ambiguity to their position amid the highly political atmosphere of the 60s. Recently, however, with the growing interest in connecting art and everyday life since the 90s, they are being re-evaluated. For this project called Thunder, they climbed a mountain each summer for 10 years and involving carpenters and various craftsmen built a structure of wood and waited for lightning to strike. The project was started in the same time year with the Walter de Maria's Lightning Field in 1977, which is considered as the most famous work of land art. In contrast with Lightning Field, a picturesque project which accommodations were provided for visitors and photographs of the moments when lightning struck were disseminated, the Thunder by Play placed emphasis on the time shared by its participants of this project. Every summer for 10 years, participants worked, ate, slept as a group while awaiting for a moment that may or may not ever come. Thunder was not intended to view, but to experience through a participant-observer model. in early Gutai works, such as those of Atsuko Tanaka using bell or fluorescent lights, the role of meaning normally assigned to matter is shifted. What we see on everyday life stays as it is in appearance, but it is used in a totally different way. So the viewer is made to feel as if thrown off from the stable condition of the coding system they usually rely on. These acts of creation that employ participation and observation of the things and its environment, rather than trying to represent something as a subject, approaches the everyday life in method called something like ethnography. The looking at things in order to blast subtly shift our fixed perceptions of them also characterizes the idea of Shuzo Takiguchi, an art critic, and Jikken Kobo, in English called we call experimental workshops, surrealistic works, especially in their works using new technology. The viewer watches a sequence of still images in their works using an automatic slide projector. The artists were offered the use of this machine by Tokyo Tsushin Kogyo, a company that later became Sony. The slide images changes to the next one according to the selected points on the magnetic tape. Hiroyoshi Suzuki or Toru Takemitsu, the musicians of this group, use this magnetic tape to make concrete music compositions. The important role of such an audio-visual technology is that it enables the artist to pick up something left behind the consciousness. It unveils the mysterious and intriguing character of the banal everyday things. So these are the slides from this auto-slide projection works. The next artist I'm going to refer is Takahiko Imura. He's using film and video in his work. And this is his early work called On Eye Rape in 1962. He picked up a footage film from a trash, which was for science education, showing how the plant grows. Then he made a hole in many of the frames with a hole puncher. So the projection of this film makes a flicker effect. The act of picking up an abandoned film and also his materialistic approach to the film characterizes this work. In the post-war years, artists frequently objectively observed the human with contradiction and defeat. This perspective was not limited to art. In the outer space creatures and monsters depicted in manga or anime, we find much imaginative imagery involving contact with non-human creatures or genderless beings that shows a similar anti-anthropocentric view, quite different from science, art, and politics, which had achieved to build up the idea of the human. To see is know long has been the mainstream thinking set followed by modern Western recognition of the world. In order to provide a stable point for knowing so that the people could agree on what they saw as a system of perspective was established through science or art and politics. This was done in order to give people control over the world they saw before them. The same system then was conversely used in defining the anthropocentric view of the world. But 50s and 60s in Japan was a time that most of the people could not trust what modern human beings has achieved. Many of the artists investigate the recognition beyond human perception. Shoji screen of Murakami, fluorescent light of Tanaka, time-shared experience of play, the investigation of noise sound by experimental workshop, and a footage film by Imura were found by the observation of everyday life and unveils the instability of the things and the life. Let's go back to the avant-garde movement in the 60s. In 1964, Yomiuri Independent Exhibition, which was a major platform for avant-garde art at the time, has ended. Genpei Akasegawa, who was a member of this higher ed center, writes an incident which, in a parent and child, having read an article that anyone can participate in this exhibition. And this father and child decided that they too would become artists tomorrow and set about thinking up an artwork. As this suggests, an anything goes situation transcended anything that closed circuit of art world had imagined. And Yomiuri Independent Exhibition ended up closing. The boundary of art dissolved totally into everyday life. Thereafter, Akasegawa, who continually maintained the radical idea that art has only a less understanding of how much creativity and curiosity the public possesses, created artworks in the form of fake 1,000 yen bills to ask judicial power to draw a boundary of art, and was charged with counterfeiting. Having lost his case in court, he later from the 70s devoted himself to a small community-based writing projects on mass media, something like an internet chat forum of today, based on articles using manga or his own essays. Then he formed a Rojo Kansatsu Gakkai, or a Roadside Observation Academy, taking photographs of objects encountered by chance in cities as if building up an archive of urban unconsciousness. His flexible turns in artistic production reflects an absence of discipline in Japanese contemporary art, but brings us to the reciprocal relationship of art and everyday life as another participant and a participant observer model of an ethnographer. So it was Akasegawa who unveiled the political position of art and artists by engagement with diverse public of his time. Capitalism and art museums are premised on continuity. They are stable and unwavering in their fixed perception of the sameness of the things. Our lives, however, are defined by limitations, and these limitations have brought us to discover how we can relate us to different times and locations. It is these very limitations that tells our diverse difference and cause us to notice the way in which we are deficient or different. The artists went out from art museums and recognized these limitations by locating themselves in the vernacular everyday life. Art today does not represent a space of meaning as an icon to fill up our living space, but rather suggests a deficiency or potential for shift or undertakes a relocation of meanings. This shift is an act of observing and moves in horizontal direction from a vertical direction of modernism. The examples I refer to are small in number, but I think it is very important to recognize the unstable condition of art in society of Asia as a discursive space for rethinking the institutionalized art of the West, for continuous rethinking of the connection between art and our everyday life. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Michiko Kasai from Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography, and since Sumitomo-san already said the thank you to the everybody, I should say, so I just say thank you very much for giving me such a great occasion and to present the I would like to just say that, thank you all and giving me such a great occasion. And I'm going to talk about contemporary Japanese women's self-awareness in the work of Japanese contemporary art and photography, which is based on the show right now in the Museum of Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography, where I'm working on. So if you have a chance to come to Japan and Tokyo until December 9th, please visit the museum and take a look at the exhibition. So I should read the paper. Okay. Barbara Kruger first published her Your Body is Battleground work in 1989. It was extremely powerful work that once seen never forgotten. Its simple slogan expressing the message that the personal is political and the women's body is site of various conflict. Approximately 20 years has been passed since then, but do our bodies still remain a battleground? Yokomizu Shizuka's Forever is an interesting work that deals with the subject of old age. This work received particular attention after being selected for the exhibition curated by Franco Bonomi at the 50th Venice Biennale. Consisting of two screens, one shows an elderly woman playing piano, a pianist playing a waltz by Chopin. Then as the tune comes to the end, the pianist is replaced by another repeated the same piece. The other screen shows the spaces in which these pianists live. For instance, while one pianist is playing, the screen will present an endless view of a cooler corner of a garden. The camera is fixed, and apart from a single movement in a branch of the tree, the screen remains static. Also, each of the four pianists play the same short waltz by Chopin. It sounds different each time. The tempo, dynamics, the finger movement and timing, the emotion that is transmitted through the music, all of these minute difference combined to create individual style. Those women are all over 70 years old and they may well be living alone. When they are sitting in front of piano, they project an independence of spirit that can only be through the passing of time. The beauty of existence without excessive reliance on anything. This is quite different from what used to be expected of old women by society in the past. What do we have to do to be able to live peacefully as human individual without relying on our roles as somebody's daughter, wife, mother, or grandmother, a business title, profession, or extent of our asset? It is easy to talk about independent spirit, but this is not something that can be achieved simply through age. At the very least, it is necessary for one to define ourselves subjectively within society and to become one's own person. The huge number of self-portraits produced by Sawada Tomoko can be considered the result of her trying to express women as an individual subject. She portrays the situation that many women of her own age find themselves in while examining the value and role that are forced upon women by society. In Masquerade, could you change to the Sawada Tomoko, please? This is Yokomizu's work. I'm sorry, I should mention it before. Okay. In Masquerade, in which she appears in the role of 50 club hostesses, or her latest work, and this is Masquerade by Sawada Tomoko, and Tiara, she turned an even cooler gaze on Japanese society's value and its penchant to judge people according to their use or external appearance. Tiara used a huge 4-meter screen as a platform upon which to present 15 women posing, smiling, with perfect hair and makeup, wearing white formal dresses. Although their appearance seemed diametrically opposed to that of 50 club hostesses in Masquerade, the message that both groups are trying to transmit remains the same. The women in the beauty contest adopt innocent look in an effort to select it, while the hostesses are chosen for their inviting smiles. In both cases, the women are trying to adapt themselves to the standard of beauty and fit into the roles that society dictates for young women, willingly participating in a system that set women against women. They volunteer to become subjects to be observed and are quite aware that their looks have a best before date, but they treat this as an advantage, altering their body into fit the standard of those who dictate beauty in effort to win recognition from society or earn the money to live. Appearance should utilize accepted value as they make their way through life. However, once the value of other men have been engraved upon their bodies, will they be able to conventionally change them as easy as changing their clothes? Could you change to Takashi Junko work, please? Takashi Junko's video embodies a conflict faced by young women who live in the city. Her work, Tokyo Meet, shows a solitary woman standing and moving at the junction in Marunouchi District, or the lobby of a tall building. The woman in her photograph works all gaze straight back at the camera. The women who work for the major corporation are surrounded by transparent cube like a cage, but even though they are prevented from moving, their shape gaze penetrates through to us. The women stand straight, coming to the verge of the collapse before managing to recover again, much like Japanese society. But what do they see when they gaze back at us? Women's deep felt need for satisfying job and economic independence, coupled with a meaningful relationship and the choice to work within raising children while raising children is not easily realized. Those who do pursue the career suffer discrimination and find that corporate glass ceiling remain impenetrable. Moreover, the amount of time Japanese men spend on housework and child care is the lowest in the world. So if a woman returns to her job after having children, they will find that in addition to their job, the task of doing the housework, raising the children, and caring for old or infirm family member will all fall in them. Trapped in an invisible cage created by social system, they gaze at the reality that it can be said that the image that appear in Takashi Junko's work of women on the verge of collapse, who then managed to pull herself back up straight again, symbolize contemporary women in Japanese society. Could you move to Shigareko's work? Perhaps the biggest change to be occurred over the last 20 years is that of women's consciousness of their sexuality. Up until at least 80s, it was taboo for teenage girl, mature women, single women, to be considered to have a sexual body. Today, however, even the most conservative people would hesitate to stipulate that virginity was the precondition for marriage. To despise geriatric sex or object to single people with a sexual body. Even marriage is choosing to inhabit both partners' sexual freedom while a person's sexuality, be it gay, lesbian, or sexless, is gradually becoming recognized as a personal preference and right. The image of women's sexuality had become distorted through men's portrayal, but with the personal world and artistic expression, women are finally managing to regain control over their own bodies. Shigareko portrays sexual fantasy of contemporary people. In her Lilies series, she wins the cooperation of all inhabitants of apartment block in East London, then hanging a black backdrop from the exterior wall of the building. She photographed all of them. In the Canary series, she began to ask the people she met in Sendai and Australia to tell her what they imagined when they thought of bright place and the dark place. Then she actually visited these locations to photograph them. Each individual work is filled with powerful energy, but they create strangely acute yet tranquil impression. Shingaleku used the body of the others to express her own disturbing dream or sexual fantasy, which reached such a level of unease that they sink back once more into serenity. While we may find ominous atmosphere of her image frightening, we are simultaneously attracted to them. Perhaps it is because Shingaleku's photographs bring our insanity and desire to each of us hold within us, but wish to avoid confronting. Do our bodies remain battleground? Unfortunately, the answer to that question can be only be yes, they are still battleground. But the consciousness of women who own their body has changed. It is society that has not changed. Society and the men who are the one with power to construct and operate the social system. Generally speaking, Japanese museums today are forced to concentrate on the ever greater efficiency, making it difficult to feature up-and-coming artists who are not expect a big audience or even to collect new works. Critique of art and photography is lacking in depth. The art market is immature. There is a shortage of grant and endowment for the art. Artists' social standing is low, and people lack in respect for them. It can hardly be described as a being environment conductive to create work. Every individual is trapped within the invisible cage that is the social system, very much like a woman portrayed by Takashi Junko's work, gazing at reality coming to the point of collapse, but then pulling themselves up again. To live in a society as oneself without having to struggle, to be able to live in a world of love instead of having one's bodies made into a battleground, whatever one's age. This is the kind of world that women's consciousness has long prepared them for. Thank you very much.
Hello. Since we don't have too much time left, I will just start reading from my paper. I'm a little bit worried about the correspondence between my speech and the images, because the images are looped. So please allow me to stop as I have to change the images from one section to another. Today I'm talking about the pop attitude in Japanese art. And it's not specifically related to the particular style, but it is a spirit. So let me read from my paper. The pop art in Japan is generally thought of as artistic style that incorporates formal characteristics and production methods of contemporary popular culture, such as manga and anime. But I would like to redefine the Japanese pop in a broader context. I will consider it as the spirit of transformative cultural reception that drastically changes ideas and artistic styles received from the dominant culture, like the American culture of the post-war years, according to the specific demands of the indigenous culture, and combine the results with the reinterpretation of the repressed conventions found in Japanese history or everyday life. Its ultimate purpose is to invent a new form. The Japanese pop is an attitude that constantly reappears in Japanese history, especially at the crisis in which Japanese culture experiences splitting. Using foreign influences to articulate the uniquely Japanese way of dealing with reality, the Japanese pop reveals the fundamental hybridity of Japanese imagination that expresses its originality through the dialectical use of the alien and the outside. At the same time, the Japanese pop attitude is strongly linked with the development of the post-war or postmodern Japanese culture, which developed between the 1960s and the present. It was generally formed in response or reaction to the effects of globalization after the American model, including the permeation of domestic Japanese life with influences of mass production, mass culture, and mass communication. The recurrent appearance of the pop tendency in the post-war period marks the three stages or phases of its manifestation, demonstrating at each moment the artist's confrontation with the proliferation of popular culture and the deployment of the contemporary lack of cultural hierarchy for the creation of a new form and assertion of the contemporary sensibility. I will overview the attainment and the background of each stage. Japanese pop art appeared in the 1960s as young designers and artists, under the obvious influence of Andy Warhol, took advantage of the medium of mechanical reproduction, such as silk screen and print media, to assert the role of artists as the iconoclast of high art and the producer of the new communicative medium. Tadanori Yoko was central to the first emergence of the Japanese pop attitude, as he demonstrated not only the heterogeneous style that condensed various visual and informational sources, but the antithetical attitude that contested the imported version of modernism. By reasserting the creative possibility of the indigenous medium and mixing it with more consciously experimental expressions, Yoko demonstrated his pop spirit mainly through the posters he created in the late 1960s and the early 1970s for the experimental theater and the dance of his time, respectively called Angura Theater and Buto, led by such dramatists as Juro Kara and Shuji Terayama, and by the dancer, choreographer, and theorist Tatsumi Hijikata. Yoko combined formal characteristics of ukiyo-e, the traditional Japanese woodcut print that became popular in the 19th century, and the method of silk screen. He incorporated into his expressions ukiyo-e's flat presentation of space and decorative distortion of stylization of human figures. He also utilized the merits of silk screen to collage various photographic images. He thus invented the new type of graphic art that powerfully conveyed the emotional intensity and the experimental spirit of the Angura and Buto through its eroticism, dark humor, and the daring juxtapositions of heterogeneous details. Okay, it's going too quickly, but it will come back again. The second stage of the Japanese pop expression took place in the early 1990s, as younger artists critically reflected on the ability of popular image to convey the collective dreams and anxieties of the people living in the postmodern age. Such artists as Takashi Murakami, Kenji Yanobe, Mariko Mori, all born in the early to the mid-1960s, incorporated popular icons borrowed from well-known anime and manga or cultural stereotypes used by advertisement. Yanobe repeatedly visualized the fear of the atomic extinction of human races as a price of the endless pursuit of technological progress, and Mori put herself into the costumes of such outlandish figures as extraterrestrial creatures, mermaids, and the goddess of some pagan religion, stranded in the materialistic age, still expressing her longing for a spiritual wonder. Murakami was the most conscious of the subversive power of pop. He attempted to formulate the theories of Tokyo Pop and Superflat during the years between 1996 and 1999. His aim was to extract from the often despised expressions of contemporary youth culture, especially that of anime enthusiasts called otaku, the hybrid art form that conveyed the fresh spirit of experimentation that disrupted the distinction between high and low, beauty and ugliness, and originality and imitation. Murakami defined Tokyo Pop as an art that uses the apparently disadvantageous conditions of contemporary Japanese culture, including the lack of stable art market, the absence of the powerful system of legitimation, and childishness. He suggested the artist to use those elements as a springboard for creating the unique art form that reflected the chaos, anguish, and freedom of contemporary experience. Murakami, in the theory of Superflat, Murakami pointed out the stylistic similarities between the distorted proportions and the decorative excess of anime drawings and the eccentric presentation of the 18th century Japanese painting, generally called the Edo Mannerist painting. He pointed out the uniqueness of the Japanese formal imagination that deviated from the traditional organization of space and mimetic representation to release the Baroque play of lines and decorative composition of color fields, indicating the atavistic reinstating of the postmodern Japanese pictorial sensibility by pre-modern Japanese pictorial sensibility by the postmodern art of anime. Murakami's reshaping of pop art as Tokyo Pop and Superflat exemplifies the spirit of the Japanese pop as that of transformative cultural reception, making the radical subversion of the hierarchy between high and popular art, as well as claiming the most domestic feature of the Japanese art practice as possessing the internationally competitive element. His theories extended the reflexive potential of pop art as a mirror of the unexpressed emotions of people towards their time. Murakami thus indicated the possibility of redefining pop as the principle of creating a new art through the reevaluation and the transformation of received influences and the repressed, outmoded, and insignificant aspects of the indigenous life. Murakami's formulation of Japanese pop inadvertently recapitulates the idea of pop presented by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's book on minor literature. They explain pop as an art or writing of the socially marginalized groups that transforms the techniques and ideas received from the dominant culture according to the childlike whimsy and deliberate misinterpretation of the original in order to suit the present needs. Deleuze and Guattari define pop as the attitude of the common people as opposed to the specialist view that utilizes various pieces of information to make up an individual body of knowledge beyond conventional categories, attaining the freedom of spirit and effectiveness of an immediate action that escapes the highly regulated form or language of the official high culture. The idea of pop as a spirit transforming major cultural influences is fully demonstrated by the younger artists who emerged in the late 1990s and the early to mid-2000s. With a more unconstrained and ephemeral, humorous, and finally freely rational style. I name this movement micropop. Its representative practitioners are Ryoko Aoki, Tam Ochiai, Hiroshi Sugito Shimabuku, and others. The micropop art presents two basic attitudes. One is the accumulation of heterogeneous images, regardless of the original context and in the absence of a totalizing idea, in order to suggest a unique path of imagination. Jaza is the use or the use of obscure or outmoded things to create a new situation to find the hidden potentials of banal things and places, inviting the spectators to rediscover their fresh relations to things and other persons. Although the micropop artists also use fragmentary images apparently influenced by cartoons or employ humorous and absurd actions reminiscent of slapstick comedy acts, they show no specific sources of reference for their images, dissociated from specific discursive contexts, but still retaining evocative power. The images in the micropop art stimulate the viewer's memory, encouraging the viewer to put them together with new images in his or her own memory bank in order to make up new constellations. Ryoko Aoki makes drawings in which her thin, unaccentuated lines keep transforming into such different images as flower petals, bones, meandering paths, rivers, valleys, and mountain ridges, indicating the chain of metonymical association evoked by the gestural resemblances between small details. Tamura Ochai indicates the constant exchange and reversal between the figurative and the abstract, the inside and the outside, through his ephemeral drawing of human figures and animals, presented as extinctions of whimsical lines and color dots and geometrical shapes. Shimabuku visits a small town to find an obscure legend to create a social situation in which people can gather and spend time together to refresh their relation to the local place or build up new relations with others. In Swanji Jack Memorial Dog Swimming Competition in 2005, for example, he used the legend of a dog that repeatedly saved the lives of drowning people in the 1930s. He used it in order to set up a one-day event on the beach for dogs and their owners. Shimabuku also made an effective interventionist action by immediately responding to the disaster of the Hanshin Awaji earthquake in 1995. He put up a sign in which the message, "The chance to recover your humanity," was written on the rooftop of his friend's destroyed house, which faced the railway, in the hope of letting the passengers on the train see the message. Using the house's specific site and taking advantage of the short period of time before the house was demolished for rebuilding, Shimabuku made the best of the limited situation to give a hopeful message to those who would be his potential audience. The works of these artists are modest, using inexpensive, even expendable materials, and applying simple techniques that can be adopted by anyone. Still, their transformation of everyday objects and situations refreshes the viewer's perception of the phenomenal world. This transformation of the uneventful life through the disintegration of its logical order and the reuse of the outmoded or parochial things realizes the definition of pop by Deleuze and Guattari in the manners more relevant to the ideas of the minor literature and pop. I'll just wrap up. Just three stages of manifestation of the Japanese pop present the mode of imagination that creates new aesthetics and ways of dealing with reality through the creative transformations of both received and dominant forms and obscure indigenous experiences. This is the imagination that gives out a new life through the reuse of what seems to be the debris in a cultural wasteland. It is not accidental that the three stages of the Japanese pop art appeared in the late 1960s, the early 1990s, and the early 2000s, as they were all periods of a rapid and large-scale reconstruction of social life and the great confusion of cultural values. Reinterpreted as a way of responding or reacting to the crisis of culture brought by the global age and articulating the unique Japanese imagination through the creative modification of received influences and reinterpretation of indigenous cultural experience. The Japanese pop attitude can be seen as a way of dealing with the specific conditions of Japanese modernity or postmodernity, turning the disadvantage of Japan's passive insertion in the process of modernization into the opportunity to create a new artistic position. Each example of the Japanese pop tendency explicated here presents a characteristic of a minor culture articulating its uniqueness through the simultaneous application of and deviation from the dominant Western model. At the same time, the ability of the pop attitude to assert an individual position or singularity of expression in the midst of the worldwide dissemination of the Western-style modernity becomes relevant beyond the confines of Japanese culture as a way of surviving in the global age. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Tatehata, the director of the National Museum of Art of Osaka. For me, or maybe for all of Japanese curators, this museum, MoMA, looks like a sort of sanctuary. So it's a great honor to have a chance to speak something about Japanese contemporary art in this auditorium. Today, I want to speak about Onkawara, reconciling Onkawara related to the Japanese own culture. The title is Japan Rejected or Not. I'd first like to introduce tanka. Tanka is a short format poem like the haiku and a major genre in the realm of poetry in Japan. You may find it strange to bring poem to the beginning of the lecture about post-war Japanese art. But in considering the question of identity regarding the works of Onkawara, I thought it might pose a critical point of view. The poet Shuji Terayama is a representative among the post-war poets. I quote his tanka. Strike a match to puff the momentary ocean mist. Is their homeland worthy of casting away one's life? Machi ippon suru tsukanoma no yami kiri fukashi mi o suru hodo no sokoku wa ari ya. It's Japanese. The poem expressed the momentary state of mind of a young man as he lights a cigarette at a lonely coast on the north country of Japan, while watching the overhanging ocean mist thicken. Terayama wrote this tanka in his late teens, when during the 1950s the consciousness of defeat in the war loomed strong. Until just before then, it was considered a matter of course to give one's life for the sake of one's homeland. And Terayama himself may not have questioned it all that time. But what begins to surge standing before the ocean mist is a sense of loss of the homeland. And whether it was worth it of martyrdom. The lit of match burns and the fleeting light symbolizes the emptiness of attributing one's identity to a sovereign state. What is expressed here is a power of consciousness fraught with euphoria in making such a pronouncement. Like referring to a taboo, being Japanese as ever before, but the homeland becoming an obsolete word. The subject of the poem is unmistakably the poet himself. In Japanese, there is a tendency to drop the subject in a short format poetry of tanka and haiku. Although it is not simply about the abbreviation, but the particularity of conveying the first person, watakushi or I. The I abbreviated in this tanka represents not only the author, but the subject who can be substituted for anyone else who finds himself in Japanese post-war situation. In this poem, when the young Terayama pronounced his identity as a poet who lost his homeland, disavowing the consciousness to attribute himself to Japanese through the form of tanka, quintessential format with Japanese culture, if it were to be described as the proclamation of an exile to a disquieting universal realm, takes on an inevitable meaning. And that proclamation, because of the non-existence distance of the subject, serves to predominate the post-war Japanese psyche. Onkawara has one of the deepest ties with New York among the artists from Japan. He left Japan at the end of the 1950s and is still based in New York today. He was in Japan until his late 20s, and despite establishing a certain level of recognition as an artist there, has not openly discussed his relationship with his cultural tradition of origin. In fact, he vehemently strongly rejects being seen as an artist with a Japanese identity. Of course, the reason for his rejection is not simply due to his attitude as a New York artist or hatred of Japan. He may have disavowing conscious of belonging to any particular culture. Onkawara's relation of Japanese background and at the same time his conscious effort to distance himself from positioning with New York context is discernible. This reminds me of Onkawara's angry disapproval when I previously juxtaposed Joseph Kosuth as an analytic conceptualist and Onkawara as a synthetic conceptualist. My viewpoint may have been overextended, but be that as it may, to Kawara, Kosuth's work is privative of his. Today, the affirmation of one's identity, leaning towards the current trends of multiculturalism or cultural pluralism, is constant. But for him, the situation was quite the opposite. Dare I say that his works have characteristic with evidence of the absence towards belonging to any particular culture. He can classify him with no tie to the dichotomy of globalism or multiculturalism. If Japan is rejected, or if consciousness of belonging not only to Japan nor to any particular culture is disavowed, then how does it relate to the issue of an exile to a universal realm? What I would like to take up is the issue particular to universality, issue of exile, that invalidated dichotomy. This may likely come across in much the same way as Shuji Terayama's ambivalent consciousness towards Japan, as I might venture to say, the consciousness of absence. About the works of Onkara, his today's series began in 1966. While keeping the exact method of the date of particular day, he has continued to do so for over 40 years. Many theorists have pointed out that the first person, I, lurks behind this impersonal symbolism. As long as the subject of the series I, such as I went, the files, maps, I got up, printed on postcard, I'm still alive by telegram. Date painting can be defined as a first person painting. Then, can the first person in these paintings or the I in I'm Still Alive by Onkawara, I'm Still Alive, be Onkawara himself, the actual person? The date is shared, and his message of I'm Still Alive is a reality of all those who received it. While the person is Onkawara, there is the inclusion that it could be anyone. I believe that being something to be shared is disquieting shadow that must be embodied in the exile to universal realm. Takashi Hiraide, the poet, in his lecture in Cologne, Germany, in 1995, about Onkawara, brought us a fascinating point of view regarding the wavering person Onkawara's work. Quote, I do not doubt that message I'm Still Alive is a clear confirmation of life by the artist himself. However, the one word still is in the message within the small oscillation between the past and the present border on the continuity of genus. To say I, by eliminating the individual of the other from the subject, by eliminating the individual ego of Onkawara from the subject, with the lineage of elimination, the I includes the dead. In other words, the I includes the genus. End of quotes. Having written that, Hiraide posed a rare comparative viewpoint between modern literary genre particular to Japan called Watakushi Shosetsu and Onkawara. The translation of Shosetsu is novel, and Watakushi I is a word that can be translated as private. In short, there are novels that can be said to paint the stark naked personal life and human relations of author himself. Onkawara, as an exile, has rejected that made himself absent from this psyche, the wet sentimentality of the I novel. However, Hiraide points out that one aspect of the I novel is that the I became ambiguous, and in seeing that as a positive, how to make the I extinct in response to the transcendental things that are hidden in everyday life became a big thing dealt with by defined meaning. From that definition, Onkawara continued to fundamentally touch on the major theme of I novel, elimination of the subject, the extinction of I. Hiraide also notes the use of the word used in today's series. Although the words are selected fundamentally based on the place where Kawara happened to be in Japan. In Japan, is used as an exception. The language of the language of the place of his own origin is eliminated, and what is the foreign language to Kawara is applied. It's Esperanto is used as an exception. From my understanding, the intent of the Esperantist is the commonization of language other than one's own native language. But on the contrary, Kawara makes a common language by the negation of his native language, according to Hiraide, quote. This is on Kawara hanging his relationship with the Japanese language in outer space. In other words, he continued to maintain a special relationship with his native language, whether by elimination, absence, or isolation. End of quotes. The identity hanging in the outer space is the issue that many exile artists must face. However, whether that evokes the disquieting situation of the exile to universal realm by the extinction of the main speaker is what only Onkawara in his work can do in the replacement of I as a subject, which connected not only with the most essential issue of I novel, but also overlapped with the absence of the subject in the tanka form of literature. In consideration, by neutralizing what must be eliminated, using a pronoun for the subject and Esperantoization of the native language, Kawara makes himself global or cosmic being. My argument here is only a rough one. In art history, Onkawara must be positioned as a pioneer of conceptual art. However, I do not believe that this does not necessarily contradict the consciousness of his particular exile. By setting the issue of absence, the real culture phase on the contrary, can be become evident. The Shuji Terayama Tanka poem I introduced at the beginning is an interrogative, not declaration. This is indeed the unfinished business of history before us that continue to evoke and compare our senses. This is my one-sided viewpoint. I would be interested in the keen opinion of my dear friend in New York. With this, I end my presentation. Thank you.
I want to invite my colleagues up here to the table, please. Thank you for such incredibly rich presentations, and I would just add my thanks to our colleagues here tonight, but also to you in the audience for joining us. I know many of you have much longer and more in-depth experience, even certainly than we do here, with Japanese art, and so I really hope this will be a dialogue with you as well as among us up here. And I also want to just introduce Mrs. Sumi, who will help us with translation as we need it. I have lots of questions, I think, mostly points of maybe clarification a little bit for myself from the presentation. So maybe I'll just pose a few questions and then we can open it up to the audience for your discussion as well. I wasn't going to start here, but I think I will. It occurred to me that in each of the presentations, this idea of the everyday, of kind of everyday existence, came up in a number of different ways, and I thought maybe as a way of looking at that in each of the papers just very briefly might help us begin to think through some things. So certainly in Mr. Tatehata's paper about Ankawara, this idea of kind of the locating of the artist's almost a physical kind of location, but a conceptual location in the everyday, literally through this daily activity of making a painting, setting the time and date. In Mr. Sumitomo's paper, this idea of the ethnographic, as I understand it, and the art of the everyday, in a way, as it is kind of coalesced in the works of these different collectives working post-war in Japan. As I understand it, I think, from Midori Matsui's paper about Japanese pop, almost this idea of the indigenous as the everyday, or the everyday as the indigenous, this kind of mining of indigenous culture by a younger generation of pop artists. And then maybe in Mrs. Kasahara's paper, thinking about these, particularly the work of the woman photographer who's looking at sort of the corporate everyday, literally the everyday existence of these Japanese women and the kind of duality of their everyday existence. So this isn't so much a question, I guess, as a kind of an observation. I don't know if anyone would like to respond to that at all. If not, I will. Yeah?
I was also thinking how the theme of every day runs through everybody's presentation today, mm-hmm. and it seems very important because Mr. Sumitomo was trying to introduce the relatively obscure, relatively unknown avant-garde movement in Japan. And earlier on, in today's conversation with MoMA curators, the problem of ephemerality of Japanese contemporary art movement came up. Mm-hmm. And I think the emphasis on everyday in each artist's activity mm-hmm. presented today mm-hmm. was a way of challenging the conventional idea of art as presentation of an aesthetic form and the demonstration of special skills, you know, instead of like, you know, so that in other words, it was a kind of like, you know, critique of high art as an institutional with the institutional emphasis on the formal integrity and the marketplace emphasis on the aesthetic form as a precious experience, as a precious object. Mm-hmm. So there was this subversive element running through the art activities presented by everybody mm-hmm. on today's panel.
Does anyone else want to?
Yeah, the reason I used the word ethnography is that I think in the 60s, there are a lot of the artists who tried to deal with the political issues in America and Europe. But I think we cannot find a lot of the cases so much in Japanese cases. But with the approaches of like ethnographers or participating in an observation model, not watching the artist's role in society from outside, but a rather active role mm-hmm. in the art scenes, like Genpei Kasegawa, I think that they also become aware of their position in the society. And that so that is the something we can find difference with the cases in America and also some similarities in America mm-hmm. with America. So.
Well, and that sort of leads me to the question I was going to ask you. You also said in your remarks, you talked about, sort of looking at this model of destabilization and how, I think you said, it might be productively applied to, I think you were saying our role, but also I'm curious about your role as a curator within a major institution devoted to modern and contemporary art. How do you, or do you, in fact, internalize this idea, these ideas in your own practice within the institution and as you sort of lay out the history of Japanese contemporary art?
I just came up to think about Genpei Akasegawa very recently when I started to prepare this presentation. As Matsui-san said, that the word ephemerality also deals with the artist's consciousness about the authorship. I think it's quite different from how the Western artists become conscious about the authorship. And because there may be some less emphasis on authorship, probably it looks like ephemeral. And to think about this issue, when we put the artist's position in the history, sometimes we found the cases that artists were not really thinking the originality as a very important aspect of the work. That is also the case with Jiken Kobo, the experimental workshop. So the idea of originality or the authorship is something that we found sometimes quite a discursive thing to show the history of Japanese art. Problematic.
Does anyone else want to comment at all? I wanted to also just other, again, sort of specific thoughts that I had responding to kind of each of your presentations. I was curious about, in thinking about Murakami, and I think our understanding of his work is quite different here, and at this point, I don't know. Maybe I won't say that yet. But what I'm wondering about, there's a little bit of an overdose of a Murakami effect, I think, here, which I think you're probably completely aware of. And I'm wondering if we began to kind of have the sense that there is a sort of post-post-pop or a kind of reaction or backlash in Japan reacting to Murakami. And I wonder if you talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
First of all, I was really embarrassed to be asked to talk about Japanese pop movement because I'm not a specialist on pop. And so what I did was to redefine the idea of pop, you know, not as a style, but as an attitude, you know, the attitude of transforming, you know, received influences and also reevaluating, you know, indigenous experience. And to me, Murakami's importance really rests on the critical attitude he adopted towards his contemporary popular culture, not exactly his style. So when I referred to, like, Murakami's subconscious recapitulation of Deleuze and Guattari's idea of pop, it's like the pop with small-scale letter P, you know, instead of, like, an American pop. You know, it's not a style, it's an attitude. And Deleuze and Guattari developed this idea from the model of modernist literature of Kafka, Joyce, you know, Samuel Beckett, T.S. Eliot. So anyways, I got interested in Murakami because nobody else was doing that at that time. So, like, you know, he was trying to develop a new language to understand his specific cultural experience as a person who grew up in the post-war Japanese society, you know, in which traditional values are disintegrating under the influences of American culture and particularly capitalist culture that is, like, you know, the overspreading of mass production and mass communication, particularly mass culture. But, and also the leftist, like left-wing ideology, you know, confronted a major clash, you know, after 1972 with the red There was a kind of radical student movement that produced many killings and internal fightings and became quite self-enclosed. So after the defeat of the leftist ideology, there was no big ideology for the younger generation to base their identities on. The only thing they had was the common language they had was this culture of Japanese pop art or pop culture. And so that Murakami's approach was to reinterpret Japanese pop culture as a kind of common experience, but to treat it more critically. And then at the same time to present the similarity between the neglected pre-modern artistic styles of the 18th century painters and the postmodern styles of Japanese anime, because anime used unrepresentational approach, like distortions of figures, two-dimensional. So he recognized the similarity between postmodern distortion of space and human figures by Japanese animation, mm-hmm. and the similar approach adopted by the 18th century mm-hmm. painters. Mm-hmm. So, for me, he was theoretically or critically very interesting. It was not just his style. So, I just cut in my paper, I emphasize the danger of sliding into mannerism. If you depended too much on the specific style of so-called pop presentation, mm-hmm. It seems very strange, but the micropop movement that I presented today is most like a reaction against Murakami's style. Yeah. It adopts actually the same attitude, but stylistically it's the opposite of mm-hmm. Murakami's mm-hmm. practice. Mm-hmm.
Michiko Kasahara and I were talking a little bit earlier today and with our other colleagues here at MoMA about specifically the artists in her exhibition and other exhibitions she's curated who deal, who are women artists who deal with issues of gender or even a kind of feminist approach in their work. And I wondered if you could talk again, just for this audience, a little bit about this idea of the all-woman group show and how that functions in Japan, perhaps differently than it may function here, or I think you believe not differently, actually.
I just, got a fax from the museum, the vice director of the museum I'm working for, and the guy from the Japan Foundation just, brought it to me. And this is the fact that saying that the show I'm talking about, well, the paper I read is out of the show on view in the museum. And vice director's letter says that the number of audience is really reducing, so we have to do something. And this is, something happened every day in Japan, every day museum life in Japan. I think, gender show and women show have to be keep doing. And I think because the necessity for women's show is somewhat like there is no equal situation like men and women is equal. The absolute equal is not have done yet. Mm-hmm. And so I think...
it's not done here either.
no, not at all. So there is, so much backlash and... Japanese women's artist doesn't like to call herself feminist, or even a critical curator doesn't like to call herself or himself feminist. But the work itself doing the feminist work, so there is a backlash going on. So we don't care about using the feminism or gender, but the important thing is doing something, doing the this kind of work, going, keep doing.
I hope my
bad English is understandable, but
try
to understand the concept of it.
And then maybe finally, before I open it up, just a specific question also for Mr. Tathagata, which, again, is maybe was obvious to all of you, but a point of clarification for me, and it's a kind of broad, maybe philosophical question, which will can segue into a broader discussion, but... I wondered if kind of where your paper was going or where your thinking about On Kawara was going was a sort of an idea of a double negative, that is that by with his kind of stance of rejection and also Kusama, who I know you were going to speak about as well but then did not, but also her stance in terms of a rejection of Japanese culture and insisting on herself as apart from it in some way, is in fact a kind of... full circle or coming back to an allegiance with something deeply Japanese, if we can say that, that this idea of alienation from the homeland, as you describe it, post-war, that there's a kind of allegiance to a sense of alienation in a way, if that is clear.
Karon is an artist very difficult to understand. And, his art is always... self-mystification or something. Mm-hmm. And but your words, it's a double negative. Mm-hmm. It's a quite exact words, and it's come back to the first point. And it's like a spiral, and it come back to the first point. Mm-hmm. And but not the same point, and mm-hmm. some sort of difference. And he always enjoying such sort of game or. How to say, puzzle or something. Yeah. It's always he enjoys solving his works by other art critic or curator and so on, mm-hmm. and he's always enjoying. And the concept I explained in my lecture is one sort of point, and it's possible, mm-hmm. but always other way of. Thinking it possible, and so it's very difficult to decide. And such sort of attitude is, I think, somewhat related to the Japanese sort of cynicism or irony, or uh-huh. paradox, and so mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, but it's possible to understand like that. Mm-hmm. I want to ask the Matsui-san, it's okay. And you said, for example, Takashi Murakami's work is a typical mentality of the after the. He always referred to the painting of Edo period. Mm-hmm. And. Or Rinpa and Jakushu and so on. Mm-hmm. It's a so-called super flat like mm-hmm. painting. And Takashi Murakami is, by your words, one of the micropop?
No, he is not micropop. Uh-huh. Micropop is almost like stylistically a reaction against uh-huh. Murakami's style.
Anyway, he's pop, I think.
He
was pop. And so senses. The concept of pop, by Murakami is what's the relation between the pop notion of pop and Edo period superfluid painting?
Yeah, okay, because
is
I'm
traditional or
no, like I'm
to?
Really. First of all, my definition of like pop is this like you know spirit of using you know like the undermined you know cultural heritage and like you know. And the transforming received cultural influences in order to create a unique form, mm-hmm. that's the attitude. And Murakami adopts that attitude. Mm-hmm. He did it in his aesthetics of superflat and particularly in his theories of superflat. And what I found interesting about his choice was that the artist he focused on was like, you know, those artists were from the 18th century, or at least like early 17th century. Those are artists from the Edo period. And Edo period was a time when Japanese townspeople, like the merchant class, became very wealthy and to become patrons of artists. And artists themselves were from that class. So they were creating the new style that fitted the sensibility of the new emerging class that is almost like the equivalent of bourgeoisie, you know, in the Western world. So with the introduction of Western-type modernity, which started in the late 19th century with Japan, like opening up its country to the West, you know, politically, the import, like the systematic import of Western philosophy, science, and technology, and everything happened, undermining all that went before. So Murakami was going back to the roots of the kind of popular art that he felt as his own, and bringing it back to connect, you know, with his contemporary style to create a new style.
I think we should open it up just in the interest of time as well to see if any of you have questions of the panelists. No questions? Yes.
You started the discussion of pop with Yoko in the mid to late 60s. My question is, if your definition of pop attitude is to one of the elements of your definition of pop attitude is to uncover or exploit or learn from the indigenous or local culture. For example, Gutai is a very pop in a way that the Shiraga Kazo used the Sambaso kind of indigenous culture, or the Kyushuha particularly used the indigenous motifs and so on and so forth, especially in the case of Kikuha to Mokuma. And then, for example, also the Zero Dimension, which also used lots of indigenous aspects as a as an emblem of anti-modern. So the it seems your definition can be more versatile or expansive than looking at typically pop Yoko.
Is that a question why I picked particularly Yoko? As an initial pop artist?
I'm not sure.
I try to speak about Yoko's work because like his work was very appropriate to accompany the underground theater movement and the Butoh dance. And for me, underground theater movement of the 1960s and the Butoh, particularly of Tatsumi Hijikata, as almost like the prototype of this pop spirit that I'm speaking about. Because in that period, which was kind of pretty much, you know, culturally confused period, because Japan was just emerging from the Second World War, like ravages of the Second World War, and they're trying to make up the new cultural heritage in a way. But like what Hijikata and the dramatists saw was like, you know, this like, you know, bad circle of importing new cultural model from the United States. Before the Second World War, it was European culture that Japanese people imported, you know, particularly the intellectuals, and adapted, you know, in a Japanese way. But like, you know, Yoko. And Yoko was influenced by Tatsumi Hijikata, and Hijikata and the dramatists really tried to create a new kind of avant-garde art. Without saying avant-garde, it was like avant-garde in indigenous attire, like indigenous garment. So they consciously explored the undermined tradition of traveling troops, like circus and folk music, the popular version of kabuki, and the children's stories, and particularly unformed movements of children and peasants, you know, so like, you know, I'm really interested in this creation of new style by exploring, you know, what seems to be so distant from its idea of modernity, but creating another alternative version of modernity or modernism. I don't know if that answers
that answer the question, if it was a question.
Also, I think I'm more interested in the kind of like the postmodernity that developed in Japan in the, after the 1960s. Because Japan, I also grew up in that culture. So Japan was definitely becoming Americanized, you know, with like, you know, type of commercials and products, you know. And there was a crisis of like losing your cultural identity in a way. So I know what I find extraordinary about Yoko's practice is that he was actually adopting, you know, the American pop style of Andy Warhol, because there's no image behind, but in one of the posters he created for Hijikata's performance, he put together like, different visual sources that constituted the visual memory of Japanese people. But there was like this small image of salmon can, which every Japanese person knew and still knows. But like, you know, that was homage to Andy Warhol's Campbell soup can. So like, he accepted the kind of versatility of American pop art, but at the same time, he tried to use it in order to promote the indigenous modernist movement, you know, the modernist movement that was alternative, which looked like anti-modern in appearance.
Yeah, now I know my question. The influence of Warhol as a major, one of the factors, and then I kind of forgot about it. So the my question was really the, so your definition of pop attitude is basically American-influenced kind, and then I think my question was, wasn't there Japanese-originated pop attitude? That was my question, I think. So in a way, you answered it. And then since I know the another artist, the Ushio Shinohara, is present here, so probably he's another, the Japanese origin. What I meant is he's another interesting example of synthesizing American pop and Japanese pop, I think.
So you don't have to answer that.
Thank you for your question and comment. Any other questions? Yeah.
Hi. The focus of what has been discussed has been a lot of performance art and some of the more conceptual practices. What about Monoha, or there's an awful lot of minimalist painting that happened in Japan in the post-war era, and is... I'm just curious about the absence of any discussion of Monoha.
Is he talking about how we ignored Monoha?
Yes.
We are responding to the topic given by MoMA in a way, but you would have liked to talk about Monoha a lot. In fact, I'm a big fan of Kishi Osuga, and now he is a specialist both on Mr. Tatehata and Fumihiko are specialists on Monoha artists.
At first, for this lecture, I'm calculated to speak about the Monoha, but it's the 20 minutes is too short to explain. And but anyway, the Monoha has a quite ambivalent character. Mm-hmm. And one aspect is minimalism, and the other aspect belong to the Asian agricultural fetishism or something. And so it's very difficult to cite both poles of them. And but recently the way of understanding of Monoha is radically changed. And before that, every art critic and curator wanted to cite the Monoha One aspect is the minimalism, one aspect is the Japanese dark, deep structure. But recently, the Monohard's starting point is a tricky art. It's a, for example, how to say, tricky art, it's a, like a Jasper Johns L can. It's a same size and looks like ready-made, but it's painted and bronze casting. It looks like it's tricky. The sort of aspect is the starting point of Monoha. And Wuhan Li, is a representative Monoha artist, said the sort of tricky manipulation is for him the, to differentiate the actual world. And the sort of method he wants to use to appear the world as itself. It's very, very difficult to understand. To differentiate the actual world before us, and for that he used such sort of tricky method. And after that, this sort of zret lantern differentiated, you know? Such sort of differentiates the world as itself suddenly appeared, or something like that. And so the way of understanding Monoha is now these 2 or 3 years quite radically changed. But shift, not the differentiate, shift the phase of the world. And anyway, but starting point of Monoha is such sort of tricky art, and also the many artists of Monoha, the Monoha artists are just the same age of me. And when they were art school students, they saw the installation of minimal art. They put on the concrete block or stainless steel directly on the floor and something like that. And so they had a chance to see the actual work, but such sort of black and white photograph influenced them to learn the method of the installations. Now we called it installation, but at that time the other word. But minimal art and earthwork is a quite big influence to Monoha. But they changed such sort of one sort of the natural materialism or materialism to use the tricky way. Or, but without photo, it's very difficult to explain. But anyway, something like that.
I think I would just say, too, that it wasn't any kind of omission, just as much as we can't be comprehensive is all. And I think that the focus of this trip, we had a, you know, while it was sort of broad and immersive, it was also to do quite a bit of looking at Gutai, for example, because I think it has obvious connections to the collection here, and kind of thinking about that programmatically. So it the trip was in part structured around that. So, but something for another time. Yes, here? I think we can maybe just take one more question, and then we'll wrap up.
I have a question for all of you as current practitioners in Japan regarding the concept of gyakuyunu, which is reverse importation. And specifically, I'm talking about the concept that's often seen where Japanese artists are often ignored in Japan for whatever reason, whether there's no art market or whatever, they have not been recognized. They go out internationally and gain international recognition, and only then are they then re-evaluated and re-inscribed into the art historical context in Japan. Specifically, I'm talking about, for example, Takashi Murakami, but also Kusama Yayoi, Yuken Teruya, all these other individuals. And so I would just be interested to hear what your views are with respect to how this concept has influenced current contemporary art practice, and whether or not, in fact, you believe that this concept maybe blocks out indigenous contemporary art practice.
Mm. think it's related with the what Tatehata-san was speaking in our meeting about the difference between Gutai and Neo-Dada. He was mentioning that most of the Neo-Dada movements, the artists, went abroad.
Shinohara-san.
Yes. And but is it true that we ignored? I think you can, if we're talking about the young artists, like you can tell you, he's very popular in Japan as well. So I don't think it's happening. But it's just a matter of Japanese art scene is generally a lack of the international covering and international relationship. I think it doesn't mean ignoring. We just have not done enough. Is that right?
Two or three years ago, Takashi Murakami wrote a book titled Artist as an Enterprise or something like that. How to say?
Gates Kigyoro.
Artist
as an Kigyoro.
And in that, he wrote the artist who succeeded in foreign country, always in Japan they can succeed. Mm. And it's the only method to be succeed in Japan. And it's a no...
It's no true.
Exception.
No exception. But I think it's half truth. And Onkawara, Yayoi Kusama, Takashi Murakami, Narayoshi Tomo, Tadashi Kawamata, and other, say, the many major artists succeeded in foreign country and Western world and come back to Japan. And Murakami's suggestion is that. If you can get the success in foreign country, you must come back as soon as possible. And in Japan, to arrange his works of the West world, to arrange the Japanese tradition, and once again go, come back to the foreign country and go on the back, go on the back. It's the best way. And I think it's half true, unfortunately.
I thought that it's not just market, I think. When I was talking with Tadashi Kawamata, he was saying that he preferred to do more projects outside because there's more critical response.
That's right.
And we have lack of the critical response in Japan. That's also the something, that reason.
Yeah, there are a lot of critical responses, but there's no forum, you know, to mm-hmm. legitimate or, you know, to question or mm-hmm. test them out. Mm-hmm. So, I said before, there's a little institutional, you know, system of legitimation in Japan, mm-hmm. you know, so that artists really need to test out, you know, their talent or ideas outside of Japan mm-hmm. in order to look at Japan from a different viewpoint.
Thank you. I'm afraid we need to wrap up, and I want to just invite you all to join us upstairs or outside in the lobby for a reception. And just thank again my colleagues here for hosting us so wonderfully in Japan, but also agreeing to come here and continue our discussion tonight. Thank you all for coming.